Welcome back, everyone, to the Deep Dive. Today, we're looking into something pretty interesting, a case that shows how, well, how even something as basic as sugar can actually end up in some pretty heated legal battles. We're going to be talking about government subsidies and lawsuits and, just some unexpected consequences that come along with it.
Yeah, you know, it's true. What we're really going to be looking at closely here is the case Sugarcane Growers Cooperative of Florida v. Veneman. This is a case that really goes into some detail about the dynamics between government agencies, courts, and, well, you know, all of those who are affected by agricultural policies.
And in particular, we're looking at the USDA's sugar program and a bit of a twist they added back in 2001. So to sort of set the scene, the USDA, they offer these non-recourse loans to farmers to try to keep sugar prices stable. You can kind of think of it like a safety net. If the prices just completely tank, farmers can just decide to hand over their crops to the government instead of repaying the loan.
Yeah, it's meant to be a way to protect farmers from just huge financial losses. But I think, as you can imagine, that can sometimes lead to a situation where there's a big surplus of sugar.
That's exactly what happened in 2001. The USDA ended up with just a mountain of sugar and some pretty hefty storage costs. Yeah, that's where this payment in kind program comes in. You might hear it called PIK, and it was introduced in 2000 as a way to deal with that big sugar surplus.
Basically, the idea was to pay farmers to not plant sugar, reduce the supply, and hopefully that would drive the prices back up. And initially, this PIK program was just focused on sugar beet farmers.
Right, and that makes sense. But then in 2001, they expand the program to include cane farmers, and that's when things start to get a bit more interesting, because they introduced a payment cap. Now, at first glance, you might think, well, that's pretty fair.
Yeah, but you see, this cap ended up having a pretty big impact. And it really disproportionately affected those larger scale cane farmers because, well, they were producing more sugar, right? So they were losing out on a lot more potential payments than the smaller sugar beet farmers. So it really ended up creating kind of a competitive imbalance. And as you might expect, not everyone was thrilled about that.
Especially the Sugarcane Growers Cooperative of Florida. They actually ended up spearheading a lawsuit against the USDA. They claimed that this 2001 PIK program actually violated administrative law. And this is where we really start getting into the legal details, right?
Absolutely. Their whole lawsuit really hinged on two main arguments. The first being that the USDA, they didn't follow the correct rulemaking procedures that are laid out in the Administrative Procedure Act, the APA. They basically bypassed the whole public notice and comment period, which, you know, is supposed to give stakeholders a chance to kind of weigh in on proposed rules.
Okay. And what about their second argument? What was that all about?
So the second thing they claimed was that the USDA, they didn't meet the requirements that are set by the Food Security Act. That act requires that the Secretary of Agriculture personally has to make very specific economic findings before these kinds of programs, like PIK, can even be implemented. It's a safeguard to make sure that the programs are actually justified.
So they were basically saying, hold on a minute, USDA, you can't just throw money at a problem without doing your homework first.
Yeah, exactly. Now you might think, okay, well, this is going to be a pretty straightforward win for the sugarcane growers. Well, not quite. It turns out the district court actually ruled against them initially.
Oh, wow. Really? Why? What went wrong?
Well, they kind of stumbled right out the gate standing. The district court didn't think that they had actually shown that they were going to be harmed by the PIK program in any real concrete way. They basically said, look, you can't just sue because you think you might potentially lose some money.
Oh, so what happened next? Did they just kind of give up?
Oh, no, not at all. And this is where things get interesting. They appealed the decision, and the appeals court actually had a very different take on the whole idea of standing. The appeals court, they really got into the finer points of standing when it comes to administrative law cases, and they actually overturned that district court's decision. They found that even the potential for economic harm, like the depressive effect on sugar prices that this PIK program might cause, was enough to give the sugarcane grower standing to sue.
So basically, they were saying, look, you don't have to wait until you're already drowning in losses before you can challenge a program that you think is illegal.
Exactly. And this decision, it really had some wider implications, too. Mm. It set a precedent for other challenges to agency actions down the line because it broadened this whole concept of harm. It said that even procedural violations like, you know, denying people a chance to participate in the rulemaking process, those can be considered harmful in and of themselves.
That's huge for anyone who has to deal with government agencies and all these regulations, right? Mm. It means they've got a much stronger basis to challenge actions that might not cause, like, direct financial damage, but still have an impact on their interests.
Right. And this brings us right back to the heart of this case. The sugarcane growers argued that the USDA violated the Administrative Procedure Act, you know, the APA, which, as we talked about, governs how federal agencies are supposed to operate.
It's like the rule book for the government to make sure they're playing by the rules.
Yeah, and a really key part of the APA is this whole idea of notice and comment rulemaking. Basically, it means that before an agency goes and implements some new rule, they have to give the public a chance to weigh in, publish a proposed rule, get comments on it, consider those comments, and then finalize the rule.
It's all about transparency and making sure that everyone has a voice, has a chance to participate.
Exactly. But in this case, the USDA just decided to skip that entire process. They announced this 2001 PIK program with just a simple press release. They completely bypassed the APA's requirements.
Well, I'm not a lawyer or anything, but that doesn't sound very kosher.
Yeah, it wasn't. And the USDA, they knew they were on thin ice here. They actually tried to argue that the PIK program wasn't really a rule. They said it was more of a policy statement, a suggestion, not a binding regulation.
So they were trying to kind of downplay the significance of the program.
Oh, absolutely. They were trying to, but the court wasn't buying it. They took a look at what the program actually involved and decided that participating in PIK came with all these specific planting restrictions and penalties for anyone who didn't comply. So it wasn't just a suggestion, it was a rule with very real consequences for these farmers.
It wasn't just, hey, maybe think about planting a little less sugar this year.
No, not at all. The court saw right through what the USDA was trying to do, that they were trying to sidestep the requirements of the APA.
Seems pretty clear-cut at this point, right? They violated the APA. What else was there to argue about?
Well, the USDA, they tried to play the harmless error card.
Harmless error? What is that?
Basically, they argued that even if they messed up the procedure, it wouldn't have changed the outcome. They were saying, even if we had followed the APA perfectly, we still would have implemented PIK exactly the same way.
So they're admitting they messed up, but saying it didn't really matter in the end.
Yeah, exactly. They were trying to argue that because nobody was really harmed, their little procedural missteps shouldn't invalidate the whole program.
I mean, it sounded like a pretty risky legal strategy. Did it work?
No, it didn't. The court pretty much shut that whole argument down immediately. They said that if agencies could just claim harmless error whenever they broke the rules of the APA, well, then the APA would basically be meaningless.
Right. The whole point is to have transparency and make sure people are held accountable.
Exactly. It would be like having a speed limit, but with no consequences for anyone who speeds.
So the court, they weren't buying what the USDA was trying to sell. I'm curious, though, why do you think the USDA even tried to argue that they didn't have to follow the APA in the first place?
Well, I think sometimes agencies, they feel this pressure to move quickly, especially when they think there's some kind of crisis going on. In this case, you know, they had this massive sugar surplus on their hands and those storage costs were just piling up. So they probably felt like they had to do something drastic, do it fast to stabilize the market. And the APA maybe felt like it was slowing them down.
Yeah, I can see that. But I mean, as we've seen, even when it's an emergency, you still got to follow the law. And the court made that very clear. But this case, it's not just about the APA, right? There's another big legal issue at play here, the Food Security Act. Okay, so we've talked about how the USDA, well, they kind of botched things up procedurally when they implemented this PIK program, but it wasn't just a procedural thing, was it? There was also this whole issue with the Food Security Act.
That's right. The sugarcane growers' second big argument was really focused on what the USDA actually did, not just how they did it, the Food Security Act. You see, it has these very specific requirements, especially when we're talking about programs that involve paying farmers, like PIK.
What kind of requirements are we talking about here?
Well, the Act says that the Secretary of Agriculture has to personally make certain economic findings before they can launch a program like PIK. It's not enough to just say, oh, we've got way too much sugar. Let's pay farmers to not grow anymore.
Right. They have to actually show that there's a real need for the program and that it's the best way to fix the problem.
Yeah. It's a kind of checks and balances thing. Congress wanted to make sure that these decisions were made carefully, you know, with real consideration of what could happen to the economy.
Yeah. But it doesn't sound like that's really what happened here. Right? The USDA didn't exactly follow the rules.
No, not really. The court, they couldn't find any evidence that the Secretary of Agriculture or even someone who had been given the authority to make that decision actually made those required economic findings.
I thought the USDA tried to say that they had addressed these findings in some kind of memo.
Oh, they did. They said that they had referenced all the necessary economic considerations, but the court, they just weren't buying it. They wanted to see proof. that whoever made the decision, you know, the one who had the legal authority to implement this PIK program, had actually gone through the proper steps and made those crucial economic calls.
So it sounds like the USDA was trying to maybe cut corners again. Did they think they could just, you know, check a box and call it a day?
It kind of seems that way. And this is a really important point when it comes to administrative law, this idea of delegation of authority. You can't just pass the buck and assume that somebody higher up has taken care of all the legal stuff.
It's a good reminder for anyone who has to work with government agencies. You need to know what you're responsible for and make sure you're staying within the lines.
Absolutely. The court in this case, they made it crystal clear that the USDA had dropped the ball on both the APA and the Food Security Act.
So what happened then? Did they just shut the whole PIK program down?
Well, it's interesting. They actually took a kind of middle-of-the-road approach. Instead of shutting it down immediately, they sent the case back down to the lower court to be sent back to the USDA for proper action.
Oh, so they basically gave them a do-over, a chance to fix what they messed up.
Yeah, exactly. The court, they understood that shutting the program down all of a sudden could really mess things up in the sugar market. They had to balance, you know, upholding the law with the practical realities of the situation.
Sounds like a pretty fair solution when you think about it.
Yeah.
So what are the big takeaways from this case, especially for our listeners, you know, the lawyers and law students out there?
I think there are a few key lessons here. First off, agencies, they can't just ignore the procedural rules, even if they think they're doing what's best for everybody. Those rules are there for a reason, to make sure things are fair and transparent and that people are held accountable.
It's like a reminder that the process matters, even when you're talking about something that seems as simple as sugar.
Exactly. And secondly, this case really shows how important it is to properly delegate authority within these agencies. Decisions have to be made by the right people, and they have to follow the correct legal procedures.
And lastly, it shows that the courts, they have some flexibility when it comes to fixing these administrative errors.
Yeah.
They can be practical and try to balance legal principles with, you know, what makes sense in the real world. Well, this sugarcane growers case is a really fascinating look at how policies that seem pretty simple can actually have these really complex legal consequences. Mm-hmm. It just goes to show that the law, it touches everything, even our breakfast cereal.
It really does, and it highlights why it's so important to understand the legal framework that's behind all the actions that these government agencies take. Thanks for joining us for this deep dive.